Gregor, The Myth of Trump's Fascism, Leading Professor Explains Trump's Populism, Nationalism. By A. James Gregor on November 5, 2018. Populism has become a favorite expression in dealing with contemporary politics. Like many of the terms employed by political journalists, it has no specific definition. Unlike the formal sciences, political and social science invoke and employ terms having only tentative discursive or lexical definition, usually framed as criterial definitions in which some properties are advanced as definitive of the concept. Thus, we are told that populism refers to a political strategy calculated to address the felt needs of the general population as distinct from, and usually opposed to, the settled preferences of the establishment. Such a definition is so loosely framed that it can be applied to almost any significant variation in customary politics. Thus we are informed that V.I. Lenin, Benito Mussolini, and Adolf Hitler all were populists, as were Mao Zedong, Fidel Castro, and Pol Pot. As such, the term means little more than revolutionary. We are now told that the current president of the United States, as a populist, is somehow a member of such a list. We are assured that, like Mussolini, President Donald J. Trump is a fascist. Intelligent persons tell us that all this is very serious, but fail to offer a supporting analysis. At best, such a claim is preliminary, heuristic, and research suggestive. What is needed is an unpacking of the concept of populism to demonstrate the substantive similarities between the populisms of Mussolini and Trump. That minimally requires the provision of an applicable historic context and measurable specifics. We are provided some assistance in that regard when we are told that, as President of the United States, one of the first foreign politicians Trump chose to meet was Nigel Farage, leader of the United Kingdom Independence Party. Both populists, each in his own country, addressed themselves to what each conceived was a neglected audience and potential constituency, domestic nationalists and traditionalists. Their opponents were, and are, the politically liberal globalists and Europeanists who dominate the establishment. In the Western industrialized states, nationalism has been largely in disfavor since the conclusion of the Second World War. The reasons are many and varied and need not detain us. What we are obliged to do is understand something of how a damping of national sentiment is undertaken and propagated. One need only attend the lecture halls of American institutions of advanced learning to come away with an awareness of what is transpiring. The atmosphere there is thick with pervasive nationalism. Lecturers in social science, liberal arts, and law will opine in excruciating detail about the history of ethnic cleansing of North America undertaken by invading hordes of white settlers. They will be eloquent in the account of the horrors that attended the enslavement of blacks and the exploitation of immigrant labor to satisfy the rapacity of big business. That is generally coupled with detailed renderings of abuses suffered by homosexuals, lesbians, bisexuals, and transgender individuals, anyone who does not conform to traditional norms. These sentiments are reinforced in the entertainment media and repeated in many of our churches. Failure to accept the message without resistance exposes one to charges of racism and homophobia. Among the results, one finds a measurable change in attitude toward national symbols in the general population. And on university campuses, many students will more readily fly the flag of some third world country than that of their own nation. Those who resist are cast into the bushel of deplorables. They are those who irrationally cling to their Bibles and guns. Trump took issue with all of that. He has sought to reanimate the United States with a soft, or sentimental, if well-armed, nationalism. His populism depicts the nation as an admirable cultural and historic continuity, neither biological nor class-based. It finds its strength not in a particular ideology, but in traditional symbols, in its history, its flag, and its national anthem. His is a relatively benign form of nationalism. He is not a statist. His nationalism is neither aggressive nor expansionist. He will use, or invoke, the threat of violence whenever he is convinced, at times perhaps incorrectly, that the security, territory, or citizens of the nation are in jeopardy. Unlike other nationalisms, that of Trump's United States has no specific racial reference. It has no irredentist claims on the territory of others, nor does it seek to secure external vital spaces to supply it resources. Such policies constitute the core of Trump's populism, and resulted in an electoral coalition that won him the presidency. whatever data we have, and it is fragmentary and uncertain at best, indicates that his coalition is composed, in substantial part, of voters characterized by a relatively low level of advanced post-secondary school education, relatively low annual income, and relatively little in personal savings. As such, many of those attracted by Trump have probably avoided much of the liberal indoctrination irresistible at university, and actively welcome the reindustrialization of the nation and attendant benefits. They are relatively insecure, and many are concerned that an unrestricted flow of immigration might jeopardize their employment opportunities and standard of living circumstances. Beyond that relatively stable core, the electoral coalition contains important segments of potential instability. With the improving economic circumstances, and consequent full employment, business interests, both agricultural and industrial, may find Trump's attempted populist control of immigration unserviceable. They might prefer the flow of low-wage, unskilled labor that unrestricted immigration delivers. There is suggestive evidence that such a concern may have already matured. Although his Republicans have a legislative majority in the National Congress, Trump has been unable to secure the funds to construct his border wall. Members of his own party have shown reluctance to provide the requisite monies. Many Republicans in Congress represent business constituencies, and their evident reluctance to fund Trump's border wall may reflect those interests. As workers find employment in the reindustrializing economy, and as their life circumstances become more secure, their interests may well turn elsewhere. Their nationalism is open-textured. It then becomes unclear what their future political dispositions may be. One can hardly have confidence that their enthusiasm for Trump's populism will continue unabated. Some polls suggest that the support for the policies that won Trump the presidency may already be dissipating. Opposed to all that, we have the unwavering opposition to his populism by well-entrenched progressives and liberals. Under any circumstances, Trump can only be president for a maximum of 8 years. The Constitution of the United States prohibits any more than that. Once out of office, a successor can undo virtually everything accomplished. Little other than his appointments to the Supreme Court can have enduring effect. Given the nature of his populism, it can only be largely transient. Uninhibited by reality, Trump's opponents have chosen to attack the legitimacy of his presidency by charging him with racism, homophobia, misogyny, and the promotion of violence. Perhaps the most outrageous charge against Trump's populism is that it is fascist. No other word in the lexicon of contemporary politics evokes so emphatic a repugnance. It conjures up images of racial oppression and genocide, against a background of absolute dictatorship and unrelieved oppression. However popular the notion may be in some circles, none of this applies to the populism of Trump. Unless one chooses to speak at a level of abstraction at which virtually anything can be said, there is no fascism in Trump's populism. Those who advance the claim often argue that Trump's populism is nationalistic. So was the populism of Benito Mussolini. But then, virtually every modern populism has been, or is, nationalistic. The cry of the Marxist Fidelistas of Cuba is the fatherland or death. There has never been a question of the nationalism of Mao Zedong. Even Joseph Stalin, the Marxist internationalist, had to ultimately seek to instill patriotism in his populism. And there is no question about the nationalism of Vladimir Putin's populism. A sense of national pride certainly does not make Trump's populism fascist. Then, there is the question of charisma. Mussolini was charismatic, so is Trump. However the term is defined, it is agreed that both Trump and Mussolini can be so characterized, as can almost every other populist leader. The history of populist politics, in fact, is littered with charismatic figures. Once one moves below the level of such abstractions, one recognizes the vastness that separates the populism of Trump from that of historic fascism. In the first place, Trump's populism plays out in a viable representative democracy. At best, he can serve a total of 8 years. The situation for fascism was fundamentally different. In 1919, Mussolini founded a movement predicated on a response to what he and his followers understood to be a betrayal of a military victory purchased at staggering cost. Even before the end of the Great War, Mussolini had spoken of the aristocracy of the trenches as his intended recruitment base. He sought to mass mobilize the hundreds of thousands of combat veterans to mount an armed resistance to organized, anti-nationalist, and anti-military socialism, as well as the liberal government that supplied it its environment. His call resonated not only among combat veterans, but among property holders and nationalists as well. In the course of fascism's mobilization, it received collateral support from the national security forces that had been vilified by organized socialism. We have convincing evidence that the security forces assisted fascist squads in their armed suppression of organized socialism. Being combat trained, the fascist squads quickly defeated their opposition, dismantling their communications and command structure. By 1922, there was no force on the peninsula that could resist fascism. The king called upon Mussolini to form a government. Populist fascism had come to Italy. One need only compare the history of fascism with that of Trump's populism to recognize the irreducible differences that distinguish them. Mussolini's succession to power did not depend on the occasional votes of a transient constituency. Fascism did not seek the support of a population temporarily aggrieved by the political system. From its very founding in 1919, fascism was animated by convictions concerning the mass mobilization of a durable support base. Mussolini had early settled on combat veterans as his primary recruitment demographic. The fascist literature from the period survives and testifies to the fact. The grievances of veterans were enduring, and veterans were available in sufficient number to secure victory in popular elections. In defense of their fatherland, they had sacrificed everything. They had witnessed their comrades die in the service of a nation renewed. Fascist strategists recognized that the program to which fascism had committed itself by the time of its founding, the economic and industrial development of the economically retrograde peninsula, required protracted political control, social stability, and comprehensive commitment. That demanded an enduring and inflexible platform of support. Fascists saw that support in the multitudinous combat veterans returning from the Great War. After the victory in the streets, the veteran combat squads who fought for the revolution were organized into a militia that became the armed guard of the fascist National Party, providing the foundation for economic growth and industrialization, constructing a suitable communications, transportation, and energy distribution network, as well as collecting the necessary human and financial capital for development in austere circumstances, requires an entirely different set of policies compared to a program of reindustrializing an established system. Marshaling continued support for an entire program of national economic growth and industrial development would require the studied orchestration, or imposition, of compliance behavior. Within 4 years of coming to power, fascism dismantled the representative democracy of Savoyard Italy to introduce what would be an enduring single-party dictatorship. For fascism, this was undertaken by inculcating the population with a set of public beliefs that took on the imperative qualities of a political religion. It was instilled where necessary by fear of potential punishment, and reinforced by the collective sentiment born of the wearing of uniforms and the sharing of symbols, together with the regular performance of ritual. Similar programmatic phenomena are recorded in many of the developmental populisms of the 20th century. It has been seen in the Soviet Union of Joseph Stalin, in Mao's China, and in Pol Pot's Kampuchea. There is none of that in Trump's populism, and it would be ineffectual if attempted. The distinction here is the distinction between the populism that arises in less developed, marginalized economic communities and those populisms that arise in industrialized, and essentially democratic, nations. The one involves enduring programs of mass mobilization, sacrificial labor, dedication, and obedience, that often consume the lives of millions of innocents. The other involves winning episodic elections. Fascism is the paradigmatic instance of the first. Trump's populism is an incarnation of the second. One need only read the fascist doctrinal literature of the period to recognize the source of the difference. Fascists aspired to totalitarian control of their demanding developmental environment for an anticipated period measured in decades. Trump's populism seeks to win the next election. Its time horizon is measured in months. Almost all its tangible effects will be transitory and almost entirely remediable by its successor. That anyone should find an instructive similarity between the two systems could only count as evidence of prejudgment. liberalism's narcissism and advocacy of individual self-indulgence, its anomic and amoral lifestyle, its irreligiosity, and consequent anti-traditionalism. All consequences of abundance, together contribute to consequences that prompt political dissatisfaction among the more mature segments of the population. Such an environment precipitates the appearance of a charismatic to rally those politically disaffected and effectively disenfranchised. The result is the appearance of a conservative populist nationalism. Such reactions generally have some initial success, but they are predictably not enduring. Unless they can fundamentally alter the system through some political alchemy, they will largely disappear with new elections. There are communities of yet uncertain populism. Putin's Russia and Erdogan's Turkey are among them. They give evidence of a populist nationalism as yet not fully articulated. The properties of such systems vary as circumstances change. Their future remains obscure. Putin's Russia seems scheduled to run a course of an anomalous developmental nationalism. The differences between the populisms here considered are manifest. Those that appear in established and viable representative democracies are far different from those, like Putin's Russia, that manifest themselves in industrialized but essentially non-democratic environments. Many of the non-socialist populisms that surface in economies only marginally developed are distinctive. The populism that arose in Taiwan, South Korea, Hong Kong, and Singapore have been distinctive. Their developmental nationalism has been characteristically protracted, authoritarian, and essentially supportive of traditional values. Their populations are industrious, frugal, obedient, demonstrably moral, and overtly nationalist. Generally animated by a set of relatively formal convictions that render them compliant, they often provide the platform for what becomes a time-conditioned, essentially one-party governance. The variants of socialist developmental populism, and Mussolini's fascism was one such variant, constitute a distinctive subset. Some of the consequences of the populism of a socialist-oriented developmental nationalism can be observed in the behaviors of the People's Republic of China. After a century, China is nearing the end of its developmental cycle. Its one-party state and its political religion remain fully intact. It has its charismatic lifetime president. Professor A. James Greger is Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of California, Berkeley. He is the author of 30 academic volumes and is a Knight of the Order of Merit of the Republic of Italy.